Song for the working men and girls of this world, particularly in the Prescott area and fans of the Mile High podcast. Always an exciting show every week. Be sure you tune in and tell your friends. Lord, I'm in need of a good time song. I'm working my fingers down to the bone. Won't you send me down a good time song? Well, a good time song.
Well, hey, thanks for tuning in. This is Matt Santos of the Mile High Show. We are back at Far From Folsom in Prescott on Whiskey Row on Montezuma. Where are they located? I got a menu in front of me. You know where they are. The old Brick and Bones. The old Coyote Joe's. They are on Montezuma. Check them out, folsomyard.com. And on Facebook, under Far From Folsom, there's links at folsomyard.com for their menu, their calendar, and also links to their other social media, Twitter, Instagram, and, of course, the Facebook page, Far From Folsom. Great musical venue, great spot to get a bite to eat or some drinks. We are sitting out on the patio in a beautiful, beautiful fall day in Prescott, Arizona. I will be sitting down with Paul T. Morris, who is actually, we're already done. This is my intro after the fact. He's running out to get his guitar, so that was the music you heard on the intro. We're going to hear a little bit more at the end of the show. Mondo Gonzalez also popped in and sat on mic for a little bit. He was a guest a couple weeks ago. So sit back and enjoy my talk on episode 112 of the Mile High Show with Paul T. Morris, local musician and local voice for all kinds of stuff. He's got opinions on just about everything. Don't forget, today's show is brought to you by Amazon. Use the Amazon link at milehighshow.com to do all your online shopping. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but what it does is it lets Amazon know you got there through us, and they give us a little thank you at the end of the month. So the Amazon link at milehighshow.com. Do all your online shopping. It takes you directly to your Amazon or Amazon Prime login page like normal. So just do that. Get rid of your Amazon bookmark. Put milehighshow.com as your online shopping bookmark on your homepage or on your toolbar. Also, don't forget we got an Audible link right there as well. Over 180,000 titles available at audible.com. Use our link, shop away, get a free audio download. Free audio. That's free. F-R-E-E. Doesn't cost you a dime. By using the code MILEHIGH at checkout. Over 180,000 titles to choose from. They've got music, podcasts, books, magazines, a ton of books, lectures, all kinds of stuff on there. I am listening to Born Standing Up, the story of Steve Martin's time. One of the ones I want to get next is Based on a True Story by Norm MacDonald, read by the author. So what you do is you use that Audible link at milehighshow.com. Shop away, you get a free 30-day trial and a free audio download by using the code MILEHIGH at checkout. That's the end of the commercials. Sit back and enjoy my conversation with Paul T. Morris out at the yard at farfromfolsom.com.
Yeah, a good time song can ease your pain and bring out the sunshine, chase away the rain. Every time you sing a little good time. Good times.
Give me kind of the Reader's Digest version of Paul T. Morris, your bio. Yeah.
Condensed bio, my discography, my filmography. I'm 64 years old, near as I remember. I started playing guitar. I actually started playing drums when I was in grade school. And I always felt I was a pretty good drummer, and I was, but I didn't like being in the back of the band, so I taught myself how to play
to be
guitar.
The front man?
Yeah. I taught myself to play guitar, and I actually wrote my first song when I was about 7.
Now, where was this? Where was growing up for you?
I was raised in a Pennsylvania orphanage for 7 years, yeah. And my mother had put me in when I was 4. She was a unmarried, beautiful, long-legged blonde in the 50s. Who had a hard time getting through with it. So she put me in there, and then 7 years later, she got me out, and we moved to Arizona.
Really?
Yeah. So
now that in itself is not the norm.
No, well, it built my character
yeah.
totally.
Well, I mean, as far as being able to get back with your mom once...
That was unique.
Yeah, that's very unique. Yeah. Once a kid, and I try not to trivialize it, but the term that comes to mind is getting in the system.
Sure.
Once you got in the system, how old were you?
I was four. When I went in. I was 11 when I got out.
So to get in the system, especially now that, you know, in this day and age, 2016, there's a stronger structure in that as far as, finding homes and things.
At this time in the 50s, it was a little different era. This was a charity-driven church. It was a Lutheran orphanage. Yeah. But we raised all our own food. There was about 200 kids there. We raised everything from every drop of milk to every pound of meat to everything. We raised it ourselves. The experience was the only one I knew, and it wasn't until much later that I realized I missed out on some things, friends and sleepovers and da-da-da-da-da.
But at 4 years old, that's your norm.
Right. For the 7 years, my norm was almost like an army situation. We had a bell tower in the middle of the orphanage. When the first bell rang, everybody heard it, and they washed their hands. When the second bell rang, everybody walked in a line to the main dining room. Everything was prepared there, everything.
How big of an orphanage? How many kids?
There was about 200 kids.
Really?
And there were three separate houses for each sex, three younger, middle, and older. And it was, you know, it was a sad experience in some ways, but it gave me a great moral fiber. It gave me a great sense of needing to please, so it put me out. It made me an extrovert, and wanting to be in front or wanting to get some attention.
Yeah,
and that drove my musical career my whole life. So it also gave me insights at a very young age that you rely on yourself a lot instead of having a close family circle. It was a Boy Scout troop.
Yeah.
24 hours a day with some very strict rules. So there was no regret. When my mother got me out, I cried the day I left there because it was all I had known.
Yeah.
But when we came to Arizona, I began to experience, you know, a relationship and a life with family type of thing.
Now, so had she already been out in Arizona and then went to get you?
Funny enough, she had actually went on living her life while I was in there. She married a truck driver and moved. We had a couple relatives out in Arizona, so she danced and pranced around for about 7 years. I would see her maybe once every 3 or 4 months for an evening, or maybe over the holidays. But there was very little contact. I was adopted or tried to be adopted 2 or 3 times. I had people that would take me to their home, and had I gone that way, I would have had an entirely different life, no question.
It's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, where would you have been?
Exactly.
One couple, the one
to adopt me, he was a manager of a Westinghouse plant. He was a very wealthy man.
Yeah.
And very well educated. And I would have had the best of everything. I probably would have died of a heart attack at 46 from stress. I don't know
you that well, but from what seeing you on stage and talking and playing and at different events and stuff. And I might be completely wrong, but I do not see you in a three-piece suit in the corporate world.
I've never been able to do it. I've been a blue-collar. When I have worked, it was a lot of blue-collar stuff, truck driving, et cetera. I've been a carpenter. I've been a ditch digger. I've been an air conditioner. Yeah. I also went into radio early.
Yeah. We'll get there. So you get out to, you're 11 years old. You end up in Arizona. Where'd you guys land?
We moved to Phoenix. And the good and bad thing was my mother was a waitress. So when I get home from school, she was on her way to work. She worked at the Pink Pony in Scottsdale for years.
Still there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a steakhouse?
Yep. And
it
was the baseball hangout. She knew Jocko Conley and she knew Conlon. She knew all those folks.
What year are we talking?
63, 64. I was just 11, 12 years old.
This is when, and correct me on my history because I don't know much, but just as in my recollection from movies and TV and books and things, Phoenix was still kind of a small town, but still the only metro in Arizona, pretty much.
It was a stop.
That and Phoenix. Phoenix and Tucson.
Yeah, it was a stop between L.A. and Albuquerque and Texas as well. It was, weather-wise, it was perfect for spring training, of course. Yeah. And then Phoenix grew on from there. I remember when seeing the sign that we were at 500,000, I thought, oh, my goodness, fabulous.
We're huge. We're New York City.
It was a one-freeway town, as you know. It was 17. So you curved at the Broadway curve, and then it turned into 10 and took you to Tucson. And that's all we had. But Phoenix was a great town in as much as it was going through this, we want to be a world-class town while I was there, while I was growing up in there. So things were getting exciting. We got the Phoenix Suns. We got different things that tied us to the national scene. And but my mother would go to work when I get home from school, so I pretty much raised myself from 12 till I left.
Yeah.
And I never regretted what she did. We talked about it, and she refused to call it an orphanage. To her, it was a children's home.
Yeah.
All right. Whatever you want to call it. But later in life, after I had my own son, that's when it bothered me. Because there was no way I could have ever turned him loose under any conditions. But it was a different time. It was a different sex. It was a different everything.
Yeah.
So, my mother and I always, she parted this earth about 2000. And we parted friends.
Good, yeah, good. Parted That's nice. Good That's good to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole, she's single mom in the 50s. That was... there was a whole stigma attached to that.
Oh, absolutely.
That is no longer there. And there's no really support thing.
No, and she was a good-looking, long-legged blonde who wanted to have fun and live her life. And she passed that on to me, and I passed that on to mine.
How old was she when you were born?
She was 21.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
She had no idea what was going on.
We were talking off, you know, before we started up here. I was 44, 43 when my son was born.
Mm-hmm.
In my group of friends, I got married late. I was 28, 29, something like that when we got married.
But you were doing career and stuff?
Yeah, that and just being a knucklehead. I had buddies of mine that got married right out of high school. I had some that got married early 20s. So when my son, when Anthony came along, a couple things. One, no way. I wasn't prepared then at 44.
All right.
There was no way I could have handled being a father in my 20s.
You know,
my buddies are having they have grandkids older than Anthony.
Your listeners should know that I live my grandfather fantasies vicariously through you and your and your posts when you put your boy up or you mention what you're doing or how he's worn you out that day wanting a grandchild of my own and not having one as a drag. But I do live my grandfather fantasies occasionally through yours.
I was telling a friend of mine the other day, he has grandkids older than my son. Mm-hmm. His kids have gone to college, careers, families of their own. And he was saying, he goes, you know, I finally feel, because, you know, in our head, you know, I'm still 18, 17 in my head.
Ditto.
Until I try and stand up or climb up on this
thing. Right, ditto.
But he was saying, he goes, you know, he didn't consider himself a father. You know, he knew he had kids, and he had the really strong family bonds. But in his head, he's still the kid that we all grew up with.
Sure.
And he goes, now I'm watching them, and he goes, this is him telling me, he goes, I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I feel I've succeeded as a father when I see how my kids turned out. And I told him only half jokingly, when my son was like 3, you know, he didn't come to that realization until his kids were grown, had families of their own. When my kid was about 3 or 4, he was still alive, and that's when I considered myself a successful father. Because after that, he can scream and holler if something's going wrong. He can talk to me.
Right.
But from birth until 3, there was a really good chance my son was not going to survive.
But you have health issues?
No, not at all. I'm just an idiot. I've driven away. I've driven away from jobs with 15 grand worth of camera equipment sitting on the trunk of the car because I forgot. Or I've left been driving home going, oh, no, I left that stuff in the at the bar, at the restaurant.
Oh, my God.
There was a good chance I was just going to forget him.
I think we all go through that paranoia. Once the child's born, the minute that child is born, your life is done, your solo life. I don't care who you are. That child changes your life immediately.
Oh, yeah. We had been married 15. My wife and I married 15 years, and she got pregnant on it. It was a very surprise to us.
And it
a great welcome
surprise.
Yeah, but it wasn't like we were, we made a decision, now let's start a family. That wasn't in the mix. But, it changed the whole dynamic of what we were as a couple.
I was leading a country rock band and chasing a musical career and living in L.A. and stuff. Paul was born and my son was born in L.A.
Yeah.
And
he's what, you said, 27?
He's 36 now. 36, yeah.
You were 27 when he was born.
Yeah, I was 27. Gotcha. And I never allowed the career to stop me from being in his life, with his life, raising his life. There were times I was away, and I had a great support group. His mother was a fabulous woman for a mother, and had a good family that also pitched in. I'm an only child. Paul's an only child.
Yeah.
But their family was wonderful while I was away. But I can honestly say that, real quickly, one morning I woke up when he was about a year and a half old, and I look in his crib, and he's gone. We lived in Phoenix, about 44th and McDowell, in an upstairs apartment. Couldn't find him anywhere. Woke up Linda, Lisa, hey, Paul's not here. What? So I'm running all over the apartment complex. He had gotten my keys. He went to my red station wagon and was standing at the door in his diaper, sticking the key in the lock, trying to open. I couldn't believe it. Was like
and
6 in the morning.
He
was a year and a half. He couldn't have been 18 months old. I'm not kidding you. And I found him out. That's the sickest momentary flash I've ever had. By far the sickest.
Man.
But fortunately, it ended well. But our kids, man, if you don't have kids, have them. If you do have kids, cherish them. Yeah. They're always the future for us. And sometimes the present is so God-blessed gloomy that you turn to your kids and say, boy, I'm going to do better to make it better for you.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you strength.
Great words, man. Great advice. I tell you what, I was growing up, I'm the youngest of five. Mm-hmm. My oldest brother, been married twice, doesn't have any kids. Hey, Mondo.
We have company.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Good,
We've
man.
Got
How
a, a criminal amongst us right now.
Oh, Paul T. Morris.
Mondo. Nice to meet you. I think I met you.
Have you?
I told him, when you see him, you'll know.
Well, most people
you get to co-host
me.
Today.
Well, dude, that works. Well, when most people recognize me with my huge mohawk,
right?
I used to have that.
Right.
I recognize you when you're got a Bud Light in your hand and you're.
True. I don't do that often anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Things change, didn't
they? Things do change very quickly. Sometimes they.
We've worked it. If we haven't worked on the same nights, we've worked at a lot of the same places together.
Have we?
I played at Tailgaters.
I played at Jackass. Okay. I play everywhere. So.
Yeah, I used to run Tailgaters. I used to run Jackass. Yeah. I actually used to bartend here back when it was Brick and Bones.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
By the way, we're at Far From Folsom this afternoon.
Yes, which they did an amazing job remodeling it. I am extremely impressed. I'm kind of ashamed that I work for Brick and Bones and not this.
I love this club. I absolutely love this place.
You want it?
So do I.
Just get in there close. You want to handhold that.
I love the concept. I love the effort they put into the making music a focal point.
Yeah. Yes.
And this is something I really push strongly among friends and family. They're making an effort to make the music the centerpiece here.
Yeah.
Well, the great thing about this place is it has one of the best venues in the entire town. With the outdoor patio, with everything that's going on in town, this is one of the best venues to see a band or something like that.
It is.
You know what I really like is that upstairs room. I got to talk to Kelsey and Joe about. I want to do some of my live shows up there.
That'd be really great. Cool.
I want to talk to you about. We're going to get there because I want to talk to you about your sound system because I just picked one up. We're just running through Paul's early years brought him up into the Phoenix area. So you're running around, you're playing music early. What was some of the first, you said you started drumming early?
Yeah, I used to play in bands when I was 16. We'd play at the Air Force bases.
What were you playing?
Hard rock, you know, the Cream and
early 60s,
mid 60s, hard stuff that was just first coming out, Zeppelin and things like that. Of course, Beatles and Stones and things. But we had amazing Steve Kelsey, John Agee. I still remember their names. They were fabulous.
Any
musicians.
Of those guys still playing? Any of them still around?
I'm sure.
The first question I ask when I sit back and talk with my buddies that we grew up with.
Yeah.
Who's still alive? Who's not in jail?
Well, Hans Olsen,
still around.
You know Hans Olsen, right? Hans Olsen and I are about the same age, and it was my thrill in life to use him as a role model. Anywhere he played, I wanted to play next.
Nice.
So, and Hans is still playing, still around playing. Chuck Hall here in town, same way. He and I have shared a lot of the same venues in Phoenix.
I did not know of Chuck Hall until I pulled him up.
Chuck Hall on a brick wall, baby.
But when I met him first, he was up here at Birdcage maybe a year, 10 months ago or so. Blown away, man, and such a sweet guy, too. Such a great guy.
Yeah, he's an amazing musician. Yeah. This town has gotten so blessed. The music scene here has just exploded the last couple years.
What was the music scene like in Phoenix back in
Phoenix
the 60s
was,
and 70s?
Is likewise, an exploding scene. I was in on the crest of the urban cowboy thing.
Yeah.
We started wearing big cowboy hats. We started playing Willie and Waylon. And of course, the Beatles and stuff were going on, too.
Yeah.
But the craze, the municipal cowboy was born pretty much then. And the Bulls came into the bars. And my ability to write songs was always a third of my shows.
Yeah.
I would play any current cover hit that they wanted. And I mean, from Cat Stevens to Jethro Tull to Willie and Waylon to whatever. But I always included about a third of my own songs. And because they were constructed, a very wise man told me one time, Paul, look at the top 10, write a song that sounds like that if you want to be a successful songwriter. So I began to write my songs with that in mind. Emotion, yes, and a good dance beat, yes, but I want a hit record.
Yeah.
And I managed to get there.
You've got that, a great sound to your stuff, very unique. But I really love the stories. To me, the underlying story, the hook, the chorus is great for songs for myself as a listener, as a fan of anybody. But I love hearing an underlying story. And I've been I want to get into it, talk a couple of your tunes that we've had on the show before when you sat down with Danny. But I have in my head, and I think everybody does this, you kind of form your own story, what the story means.
Sure, sure.
And then I've read, especially now in the internet age, you can pull up meanings of songs and interviews and blogs of the songwriters.
You ask Jimmy Page why he wrote Stairway to Heaven,
and it's got
a really different idea than what you had.
Tom Waits is one of my favorite storytellers of all times, one of my favorite musicians. And when I hear his songs, I love listening to them. Like they're great driving songs. I'll slap a CD. I'm old, so I still use this stuff in my dashboard. Slap a CD in when I'm like driving the 40 to California, where you got 10 hours of nothing.
Love
and all
it.
You either listen to in my car because I don't have like Sirius or anything. It's either CDs. I'll plug a podcast in my ear, or it's the only radio stations you can get are Spanish, which come through so loud and clear no matter where you are in the world.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And religious radio.
I was just
going to
say that.
And then if you hit that right spot right around needles, it's Spanish religion. Mm-hmm. It's Spanish. But 2 o'clock in the morning, dark highway, Tom Waits going through the stereo. And what I do is I get a whole movie going in my head about what the song is. And then I read what he was doing when he wrote it, and he goes, the words rhymed.
Right, what? Right. No, that's right, not right.
You're like, don't burst my bubble.
It's a story, and it's about a guy in corduroys, and he's wearing a hat. I've got the whole thing down.
Right.
He drives a blue car, and he's got a dog.
You know, Waits put hands. You know, Waits put Hans Olsen in one of his songs.
That's where I know the name. I'm pretty sure that's...
The piano's been drinking. The piano's been drinking. And the light man's blinded one eye and can't see out of the other. That was Hans Olsen.
He was playing.
Tom Waits was playing at a place, Red Rock something. It was in Scottsdale, a little club in Scottsdale. And Hans was running. It was like a theater club.
Yeah.
Hans was running the light for him because he knew Tom. And he ended up... In one of his more famous songs,
Beautiful.
The Piano's
I
Been
love
Drinking.
That song.
Yeah.
I feel like I was born way too late because I love all of that stuff. One of my favorite bands is The Doors. I grew up listening to them. I was just born way too late for any of that.
No, you're old.
I know.
Don't knock yourself. You're old.
I saw The Doors. I saw The Doors in a place called the Eight Ball or Great Eight or Diamond Eight. It was a club in Scottsdale at a strip mall. And this was early. I was probably 16 or 17. And The Doors came through before they were well known. They were just
a club band.
Yeah. And it was lights and strobe lights and psychedelic and acid and this and that. And
yeah,
it was all that.
Yeah. So what were the hot clubs in the late 60s, early 70s? What were the places where the names would come play?
Mr. Lucky's, of course, was one of the leading country rock clubs in the country. You had the Palomino, you had Gillies, you had things like that in Texas and in L.A. In Phoenix, it was Mr. Lucky's, if you played there. Then a large group called Graham, the Graham Brothers, came in and opened up Graham Central Station. Now, I was a house band there for a while, and I did a lot of concerts there. The early days of my playing music in Phoenix actually started like at YMCA coffee houses or at Hobo Joe's in Tempe next to the college.
Yeah.
And then when the Urban Cowboy thing came in, everybody wanted to cash in on it. So every club in town went cowboy. And there was the Hayloft and Peter Bob's out on Cave Creek Road and everywhere across the town there was a place you could play. If you knew any sort of good-hearted woman or any Merle Haggard, you were in.
Yeah.
but Lucky's was far and away the center of the bigger time music scene. And then, of course, the Veterans Coliseum would be the bigger concert.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to play there with Paycheck. 1 year and the Gatlin Brothers 1 year.
That's awesome.
That was one of my rushes to be able to play the Coliseum in a town I grew up in, right? To play that, it was one of my goals in life, and it was one of those bucket
list. What
size
crowd? What's that?
12,000.
Man.
It was 12,000. And
what's the biggest house you ever played to? Was 30, that it?
30,000. 30?
Where was that?
It was in Nashville. It was at a raceway back there. It was a Vietnam Veterans salute concert back in the about 80, 1980, 82, something like that. And there was 30,000 vets there, and I opened the show along with my guitar, and did my first song, and they loved it so much. He said, "You're doing it." I was just supposed to do one.
Yeah, just
said,
do another one.
So I did two or three.
Nice,
and, that's very cool.
It was a rush. The song I did, of course, was about the Vietnam vets. Yeah. So,
what's the title of that song?
Is it Forgotten
one,
Man?
Is that still one that you're in your mix?
Yeah. That was just in a movie last year. Here in Prescott, the Ride the Thunder movie that came through.
Okay, no, I know that. I think you played that for Danny. Maybe we'll talk him into playing that for us.
Probably did.
That's actually really cool.
No, he's got some great stories, man. Some great, great stories.
Well, I wanted to say about that when you mentioned that. Songwriting is something you learn, you know, and it's not something you learn at Yavapai College. I'm sorry. You learn a lot at Yavapai College, but some real songwriting is something you live. And you go through a day and you have an episode or you meet someone or you have an incident of some sort. And then you take time later that night or early that morning and you make an effort to express it.
Yeah.
And it is an effort. It's a job. You know, sometimes it's a 3 a.m. turn the light on and get up and write job. But it's a job. And then it's a matter of being like a carpenter. You have to sand it. You have to polish it. You have to hone it. You have to clean it up. And that was my biggest failure as a songwriter. As I wrote from emotion, and by God, what I wrote the first time was what is what it ought to be.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later, and I got to hang out with some very, you know, successful songwriters, that it was really, it was given to me, if you want this song to sell, you need to change this and that.
Well, plus, I don't consider myself a writer. I shoot pictures, but I do write. I've had to do writing for work and for fun for decades. But I could write
songs.
Pictures
without words is often incomplete.
Yeah, I wish I could write songs. I can't. I can't sing, can't hold a tune, can't play an instrument. But a lot of times I really like writing short stories, fiction. And in my head, they're lyrical. They kind of weave a short little story in you know, a couple of hundred, few hundred words.
Storytelling song follows the same rules, Matt.
But I'll look at stuff I wrote 15 years ago, and then I'll bump into some guy out here on the square and it'll click. Oh, that reminds me. So I'll pull out old notebooks or pull up something on the computer, and I'll start tweaking what I thought 15 years ago was done.
Sure.
That was a three-page essay, three-page short story,
right,
and it's done. Oh, but no, this guy would fit perfect in there, and I start tweaking it a little more. And when you're doing that with songs, the way you play a song at your Taco Tuesday at the golf course, Quailwood, you might play that exact same song at the Cage at an open mic or at a gig elsewhere, and it's a little bit different, and that's the beauty of live music. If I want to hear the same song performed the exact same way, I'll get the album, I'll get the CD and play it, but to hear it live and hear it with a little bit of a different tempo, maybe another instrument dropped in, maybe somebody sitting down with percussions with you on, you know, at an open mic or something.
Sure.
To hear that whole different it plays that story in your head a whole different way.
To dress it up with different color, maybe different color chords, passing chords, or like you say, a different instrument or whatever. One thing I've found, and I think you guys have both probably seen this, when you go to see somebody whose songs you like, a star band or whatever, you expect to hear that song the way you like it.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, the way that I know it.
I want to know it and hear it, and particularly the more patriotic songs I've written. Those, I can guarantee you, will be played just like you heard it and fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
Other stuff, I will definitely stretch on and turn this way or turn that way with. But songwriting and story writing, and particularly song stories, you know, there's basic, I love you, you love me, isn't that great? But if you're trying to tell a story, it follows the same rules as short story, and I don't know what they are, but I know that you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's going to have a continuity that everybody can listen to and follow. Occasionally, when you get Purple Haze or Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, which is also a song story, but you can make your own story up. Other stories like Guy Clark's Desperado's Waiting for a Train, you see each verse as a scene in a movie.
And it's
clear what he's talking about. But getting the listener to follow along and emote and the same emotion that you're feeling is the goal for me.
How does that change depending on the venue? Like you said, 30,000, 12,000, 30 people, you know? Does it change how you present it?
Oh, yeah, your energy. My
stay nice and close.
My energy goes for how many people are in the room.
Now, do you have a preference?
Nope, it's a great gig either way. When I sit for 15 people and play, that's when I really get emotional and really tell stories and really tap on little guitar licks and stuff. When I'm out doing 30,000 people or 10,000 people or 5,000 people or whatever, it's all energy. Yeah. I need to draw their energy into me. And occasionally, like when I played here at Folsom a month ago, there was a great crowd, maybe 50, 60 people. And we got up and we did a lot of songs with beats and looked at everybody's tapping toes
getting
and
people,
stuff.
Getting people
and then
moving.
I stopped and did He Stopped Loving Her Today. Sky Daddy got up and sang with me. And then once you have people on your side on stage, then you can go, here, let me bring you in a little deeper.
Yeah.
Let me introduce you to a little another part of my heart. And then they come in and they listen, and then you feel like you've shared emotion. Before, you're sharing a dance beat. But when you can bring them in that close and wrap your arms around them musically, it's great.
Over the decades, I've photographed huge stadium shows, festivals. And they're great. Like you said, the energy's there. You know, you too at the Oakland Coliseum.
Yeah.
For, you know, it's the Joshua Tree tour. Was the whole place was you could feel the building moving, a big huge outdoor stadium. As a fan, if I'm going somewhere to listen to music, I want it in a small. I like watching being that close up. Mm-hmm. I've gone to as not working, you know, gone to concerts to go as a fan, as an audience member, and in a stadium, it's like, you know, I'm watching. Maybe this is just because I'm cheap and I don't get the good seats. But I can see the light way down below, but I'm watching it on a big screen.
Sure.
I could be doing that at home.
You can get a different environment on that aspect. Yeah. I love the smaller venues, too, because you get up close. You feel more of the story. You feel more of everything, like you were explaining earlier. I like that part.
Yeah.
In a big stadium, it's right. You feel the energy of the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's great, you know, you got that experience. But if you really want to feel that music, I love that small venue.
I don't like the crowd. Maybe just because I don't like people. I don't even want to sit here with you guys.
There are so many tricks to being a successful musician, performing musician. There's tricks to be a successful concert musician. Two different things. A guy that plays in Folsom is going to do a different show and present a different side of him than a guy that's playing at Phoenix Symphony Hall.
Yeah, true.
A whole different world. You can bring the lights down and put a single spotlight on it and stuff, and Neil Young can come out and play his six-string guitar. But that intimacy is nothing compared to coming out to a local club and there's six people, and a guy says, well, let me play you one I never play in public. And he starts going into this story or whatever. Now, Mondo is a younger age group than I am, for sure. And I'm sure his take on venues and on bands and on electronic or non-electronic is a whole different story. Are you in agreement with some of the stuff we've been talking about?
I agree with everything you guys have been talking about. Like I said, I was born way too late. I wanted to be born a lot earlier. Mine, I like more of the classic rocks. You know, I like the Eagles. I like Led Zeppelin. I like the Doors and all that. And that's what I grew up with and listened. And fortunately, my son, that's who I had him listen to, too. He did like the newer stuff, not me, because I really don't really understand it anymore. But the older stuff that told stories that brought people in, I made him listen to the actual words of the songs. And the same thing that Matt was saying earlier.
And that's a bond that you guys will always share. And real quickly, my son was the same way. By the time Paul was three, he could listen to any Beatles song, tell you who was singing it and who wrote it. Okay. But he went on, you know, he ended up being a Pearl Jam and da-da-da and da-da-da. As he grew up, he went through his music. But to this day, he's said to me many times, if I'm talking to somebody and they say they don't like the Beatles, I walk away immediately. That, to me, I felt like I was a successful musical father.
That is awesome.
And I'm sure you do it with your son.
At seven, there's a couple of CDs in the car that he really enjoys. Doors' Greatest Hits. He likes Light My Fire, and he's got, oddly enough, I'm a little worried about this, right now, The End. He really likes
The End. Oh, that 12-minute song.
But his, because I'll look at him in the rearview mirror, and he's rocking back and forth.
Nice.
And you know what? Booster. He's putting a story in his head.
But he's singing along.
Yeah,
so that's really cool. I got to watch what the lyrics are and a lot of stuff.
Some of the stuff, yeah.
But and then locally, I don't have anything by Paul. This is why. Is that you, Mona?
Yeah, I'm expecting locally, somebody. I'll be right back.
Don Cheek, huh? I'll just set it down. Here. Don Cheek, their latest release, Opposites Attract, my son really likes. And Wes Williams, Tie Dye on Tuesday, that song, my son absolutely loves it.
Very cool.
And he'll sing on it. And there's a line in there in Wes's song. Her dreams are like her tax returns. She don't know what they mean.
Ah.
And when that phrase comes in, he goes, wait, Pop, here it is. Pop, here it is. And then he sings it and he knows exactly
You know what? You've got a future musician or writer on your hands. He's already paying attention.
Yeah.
He has a CD to all enjoy.
Right. We were talking about songwriting mm-hmm. and the experiences, taking your experiences into your songwriting. Now, you mentioned a bunch of different jobs, truck driving, carpentry and stuff. Did you start that right out of high school? What was the...
I started playing music right out of high school, pretty much. I was making a living with my guitar from 18 yeah. on. At the same time, I was playing 3 or 4 nights a week, I was doing a truck driving job. Yeah. I was doing a carpentry job, whatever.
Now, were a lot of your early songs or your songs at that point? Because you said you wrote your first song at how old?
I was about 7.
Yeah,
man.
What as you were performing, as you're hitting your stride in your late teens, early 20s, were you doing a lot of originals? Were you doing a lot of
mixes together? Actually had a teacher in high school that. If I could control my extrovertedness for a while, she would let me bring my guitar in on Fridays.
Oh, nice.
And sing for 20 minutes to the class. And I still have people today that were in class with me that say they remember it.
Wow. And what a great teaching technique. She was fabulous. Your energy.
You know, I got to tell you, man, if you want to ever want to understand me, Paul T. Morris, when I was in first grade, I had a teacher called Mrs. Rape. I loved her. She was great. Mrs. Rape had a problem with me always talking, always being busy. She would move me up next to her desk, put my desk next to hers. That didn't work. Da, 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 da. So one day she came in with a picture from Life magazine. On one side was a cute little Cocker Spaniel sitting there. I never forget this. I'm 64 and I remember this. There was a Cocker Spaniel on one side. On the other side was a screaming baby. And when I was being good, she would put this up on a clip on the blackboard. The principal would walk by and just look in. If he saw the picture of the dog, he'd stick his head in and say, so Tom's being good today. You know, I went by Tom at that time. Tom's being good today. Yeah, well, that's great. Or if it was the baby showing, he would stop and pull me out and correct me for whatever it was. But I learned then that that's how I could get attention.
Yeah.
And so... I also learned that they liked it better when you had a conscience about what you were saying and doing. A lot of people get in trouble because they're rebelling, but they don't use their conscience with it. Their guilt and right and wrong doesn't kick in. So anyway, that's the secret to me. I need a Cocker Spaniel or a crying baby. And that's pretty much my range.
That's great. You're the Cocker Spaniel today. You're welcome.
Today I'm being Cocker Spaniel. You bet.
So your life on the road, you know, driving truck, mm-hmm. swinging a hammer. What were some of the stories that came out of those experiences?
The main thing was you got to learn the working man's side of things, much like Haggard would express. Haggard was a great working man writer. Engelbert and Humperdinck say huge love songs, but Haggard would write these working man songs, and he knew he'd worked it.
Yeah.
So it was a combination of doing the job. I wrote a song called Good Time Song. Lord, I'm in need of a good time song. I've been working my fingers to the bone. Oh, won't you send me down a good time song? A good time song that I could use, chase away some of this working man's blues. Send me down a good time song. Anyway, so I always wrote when I lived.
Yeah.
You know, and when I was heavily involved in drugs, some of those songs were ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, they were drug driven, they were drug explaining, and they made absolutely no sense.
So what was your substance back then?
All of them.
Everything.
I'm ashamed to say, but I've said it in public many times, I was a hardcore needle using drug injecting fool for 40 years,
man.
And how I survived it without diseases, without death, with
coming out the other side of that,
unbelievable.
Is as rare as a five-year-old, four-year-old going into an orphanage and being able to come out with your birth mother.
Yeah.
You beat the odds on a few different things.
I've been lucky on many things, man.
A little bit of everything? Heroin? What
everything.
Was it?
Heroin, yeah. Cocaine, speed a lot.
Yeah.
And early on in life, I had gotten arrested for heroin. And back in those days, you could cash a check anywhere if you could talk fast enough.
Yeah.
Anybody's check. So I got caught writing a check and going to some place in Los Arcos Mall. And it was a check for a $3 dinner. I was starving. Anyway, the point of the story is that was over a heroin abuse. And when they put me in jail for 68 days, that was when I quit heroin.
Yeah.
68 days. That was enough to realize I don't want to do this anymore. Now, I then moved on to cocaine and moved on to methamphetamine, but I never went back to heroin.
Yeah.
And today is exactly the same day as it was when I was in my early 20s. There's more heroin than you know what to do with.
And it's amazing how that can make such a resurgence.
It goes around. It's a cycle. And, of course, during election years, they clamp down more. Non-election years, they don't clamp down so much. Anyway, I could go on for hours about this, but I won't.
I came up in the 80s. It was at least in the San Francisco Bay Area, the height of the coke days.
Sure,
and unfortunately fell into that for a number of years. But
during that time, I was doing bigger concerts, touring with a lot of name acts, and
every day, right?
Just about.
Yeah,
and they. People you would not believe, and I won't name them here, but people you would not believe did cocaine daily.
Yeah, I was.
These were country stars that lived and preached the most God-fearing, patriotic life you can imagine, and these guys were tooting up out of their minds.
Well, you got to remember, cocaine wasn't an addictive, dangerous thing until the late 80s, early 90s.
Right.
Before
when they made it
a
law.
Before that, it was a recreation, and everybody was doing it, and it was a lot better.
Well, drugs, I used a lot of drugs. I did. I was arrested many, many times, but it helped form my character. It helped me live the darker angels in me, but I managed to not let them take me over.
Yeah.
I always
amazing
kept it.
To come out the other end after that many years.
Oh yeah,
and shooting up was a whole different ball game.
It was a ritual. It was we had glass syringes and we carried them and cleaned them and we just thought we were some sort of doctor. It was insanity, but it was a ritual.
It's rare to hear somebody come out the other end of that.
Unfortunately, I think it
ends badly for most people involved.
I think people that inject drugs, that's at least 50% of the addiction is the ritual.
Yeah.
It's the acquiring it. It's the cooking it or the drawing it up or getting the cotton or whatever. It's the bite when it goes in your arm. Yeah. It's the missing it and abscessing. It's the ritual.
Yeah.
The excitement of waiting to cop was bigger than any rush I got from the drug. And I threw away, I don't know how many careers and how many lifetimes doing that. Like you say, I managed to come out the other side. I'm 64. I'm healthier than I ever deserved to be. But as you say, we all know hundreds of people that didn't make it. We all know that. So
what brings you? Okay, we're going to skip forward a little bit. I'm taking up your whole day. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
But so you're playing, you're touring the country, you're playing with big names in big areas, you're playing the smaller honky-tonks and bars and clubs. When did you get to Prescott? What brought you here?
I came to Prescott 6 years ago. I was, at the time, I was in Miami. I'd working for Carnival Cruise Lines, and God, I hated Florida. That's a whole other story. But I've lived
Come
all
on,
over
sunshine,
the country.
Sunshine, beaches, and cruise ships. Why was
flat,
it so?
It's flat, and it's humid. That's all I know. It's
what
flat
were you doing
and
for
humid.
The cruise line?
I played music, played guitar for 2 years. I was on
entertainment on the boats.
I was on the boats almost nonstop for 2 years, and it was a great treat. It was a wonderful experience. I got to see many countries I never would have dreamed of, but I was single. I was early to mid-50s. And every girl on there that I was attracted to would go, "Oh, you're so funny. You remind me of my dad." Every one of them. So it was a lonesome 2 years. But yeah. I'll tell you what that time in my life did for me real quick is it let me sit on the bow of that boat and reflect and go into my heart and take this misery that I'd done in doing this drug or this misery I'd done to this girl or this misery I'd done missing this part of my son's life and allow me to clean it out, inspect it, and then throw it in the ocean.
Now, as a passenger on a ship, mm-hmm. as somebody on vacation, there's activities constantly.
Right.
As an entertainer, as a worker there, and I've talked to a couple of comics who have done cruise gigs, I don't know if it's the same way. They say they got their couple hours a day where they're doing their show, you know, early show, late show, maybe sometimes three on the weekend.
Right.
And then there's 18 hours where you're doing nothing. Was that the same as the musician?
That was very possible. The cruise ship is every 5 days or every 7 days or whatever, 3 days, whatever the cruise was, it was fun day. It was every day. It was fun day.
Yeah.
One in the morning you pull in, you drop off 4,000 people, you pick up 4,000 more, and by that evening you're on fun day again. So I played six nights a week. And you had boat drills and things that you had to memorize and tests you had to take and stuff. But you had to keep yourself busy. Absolutely. I would run or use the gym or try to write some songs.
But was that your reflection time?
It was. It was like being a little bit in solitary. I know it was 5,000 people, but you're in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, 5,000 strangers, though.
Exactly. And You got a little cabin below decks and stuff. Now, I was really fortunate. My position allowed me to use anything on the ship except the casino. There was always food. I could use the gym. I could use the pools. I could do everything. Most working people on the ship weren't allowed that.
Huh.
So I was blessed in that way. But it gave me, honestly, the most important thing I got out of the 2 years on the ocean was time to reflect, time to figure out what I'd done wrong and forgive myself for it. Or try to.
Yeah.
It still is. It's still difficult. But I came off that boat knowing I'd left a lot of stuff in the bottom of the ocean.
Where it needs to be.
And it made a difference.
Yeah.
So I came back to Arizona. I actually met. I got a letter from a girl that I dated in high school, who we had our lives had touched bases off and on over the years. But she wrote me a letter one day in Miami, said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "Of course." We talked for a year on the phone, and then I came back to Arizona. I married her 2 weeks later, and we've been, we moved to Prescott several months after that. I wanted to get out of Phoenix. I wanted to get out of the heat. I was playing at the casinos down there and playing clubs. I was making another Phoenix career.
Yeah.
But I hated Phoenix. It was too big. It was too hot. So we moved up here.
2010 Phoenix is much different than 1965
Phoenix. Oh, my God. The difference is amazing.
Yeah.
So I lived 10 years in Sedona. I lived 6 years in Page.
Yeah.
I've spent my time in Arizona and love Arizona and always want to be here. Prescott was a place I hadn't spent much time in except in the jail, in the county jail. When the jail was at the top of the courthouse. So that's another story.
Yeah, that doesn't give you a real good that, view of the town.
That was I spent 11 days here, and it was all of them at the jail at the top of the courthouse. But that's another time. So I moved to Prescott Valley, actually, and we bought a house. We got an amazing bank, what was it called, auction.
Yeah.
We bought this beautiful house for very little money, and a couple months later, I got a job at KYCA Radio.
Now, how'd that transpire?
Saw an ad in a paper. Went down and met Lou Silverstein and bugged him a week later. He said, "You got the job."
What was your role there?
I was in the morning news anchor, or a writer, interviewer, reporter. I'd never done that. All the radio I'd ever been on was all music-oriented and spinning discs and this and that. But something about me, I've always been a fan and a student of politics. local, national, international. It makes no difference. I started politics when I was in my teens. So Lou saw something he liked, maybe radio experience, maybe not. I'd never written a news story in my life. So Don Steele and John Russ beat me over the head for about a year till I learned how to do it.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful, I was there almost 3 years. It was a wonderful time, wonderful time.
Now, we differ there on your politics, because I am the least political person you will ever meet. Politics frustrates me. You could get somebody who has the best intentions, and by the time they try and get those intentions to fruition, the other sides are knocking them down. And I break it down in thirds. A third of the people love you. A third of the people hate you. A third of the people don't know who you
are. Absolutely. And you know,
you can't get anything done.
KYCA is so right-wing in their programming. Yeah. Okay, they're lovely folks. They've been here 75 years. They've been a real solid part of Prescott. It was an honor to be among those folks. Yeah. But their programming is very hardcore right-wing. When Lou hired me, I had hair down the middle of my back. Okay, he knew what he was getting. And I've interviewed everybody from the governor, every local politician. Yeah. I'm a hippie. I always have been from the moment I walked out
of the
East.
You were definitely the square peg in the round hole over there.
When I walked out of Easy Rider, when that movie came out, I went in as a child. I came out a hippie. And I did. And I'm to this day. So politically, it was a grind. It was a real friction. But I learned a new craft. I learned a lot of the great folks that power Prescott, and the area. And I love and respect many, many of them. I don't agree with them politically, but they'll know I'm there patriotically for them anytime.
Now I want to hear a couple of songs from you. Mm-hmm. So we're going to wrap up the talking portion here.
Okay.
And like I said, I am anti-politics. I'm as neutral can be,
right,
when it comes to politics on any level. But like you, I've been, because of my job, I've been,
you're exposed to it, sure,
and watching what's going on. I will bow out right now, and I want you to explain what's going to happen in the U.S. on that first week in November. What do you think? What's your gut tell you?
I have been telling everyone that the election won't take place.
It won't?
I still don't believe the election will happen. Okay, that's my
opinion. What do you
opinion.
Base that on? I mean, what's going to stop it, I guess I should say?
There are so many things they could produce to stop it, it's not even funny. Okay, there's so many issues. There's so many non-tangible things. There are so many tangible things. And you don't have the time nor the interest to hear my opinion of it. However,
you do have some very interesting opinions on lots of things. I encourage folks to follow you on Facebook because it's,
be happy
it's,
to.
It's,
you
it's
friend
entertaining.
Me? You
Paul
friend
T.
me?
Morris.
I'll be happy to
okay, let's make so the election doesn't happen.
If it does happen, I'm almost certain Hillary Clinton will be elected. I do not think it'll be peaceful. I do not think it's going to be the end of the story. It's not going to be
no matter who.
Yeah, it's not going to be the end of the story. I did not vote for either of them. I did vote, and I voted yes on 205. No, it's not perfect, but if we don't do something, I could leave here, get stopped with a seed, and be charged with a felony. That's absurd. Yeah. So I voted yes on 205, and that's all. That's as far as I'll go.
Now
I did write Mickey Mouse in on one on one write-in.
Maybe he'll win. All right, I'm going to pull out my crystal ball here.
Okay.
The election does not take place.
Mm-hmm.
The powers that be scour through Facebook, scour through radio shows, and scour through the public opinion. And on November 9th, I guess the next day, they say, you know what? The only person that can run this country is some hippie with a guitar in Prescott. Paul T. Morris is now our president. Day one, what does President Paul T. Morris do?
God, that's a great question. That's astounding.
I stole it from Greg Proops.
That's wonderful. day one, I would declare a work holiday for a week. everyone, no matter who, what, where, and other than the vital services, you take the next week off and deflate. You take the next week off and remember who your neighbors are and who your American citizens are.
Okay, 6 months in. I guess it wouldn't be November 9th because you wouldn't take office till January.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So January, whatever. Now, it's June. Mm-hmm. 6 months in. What has Paul T. Morris, President of the United States, accomplished?
I've pulled everybody could possibly be pulled out of the Middle East, number one. Marijuana is legal in all 50 states. All medical applications are now freely available to people with epilepsy, to kids with seizures. The oils are free and available and readily accessible. Healthcare is free to everyone. And people that are not paying their taxes, i.e. Donald Trump, that stops today.
I was just going to say, today. How are you going to pay for it? That there you go.
That stuff stops today.
Okay, 4 years in. Your term is up. Do you run again?
No. No, absolutely not. No.
Well, so you've got enough. A brain in that head.
Yeah, no, and I probably wouldn't get through the first 4 years. But I am definitely liberal-leaning in my agendas. I'm not unaware of what it costs to pay for things. I am aware that people, for the most part, on the upper 1% are not paying anything.
Yeah.
And just that money alone would make a difference. The money from 205 will make a huge difference in Arizona education. Huge. How people can even stop to consider not voting for it astounds me.
All right. Paul T. Morris, President of the United States, has spoken his mind. We're going to hear a song or two from you, I hope. Mm-hmm. Before we turn this off, so you can go get your guitar, mm-hmm. Let folks know where can they find you. You got a couple of regular gigs.
Sure.
Any social media website, anything you got, plug away.
All right, thanks. My political comments come under Paul Morris. My musical comments are under Paul T. Morris. Friend me on Facebook.
That's both of those Facebook.
Okay. Right, and I use people on that all the time. I friend people all the time. Every Saturday I play at Jackass 1 to 4. Saturday
the
afternoon.
Jackass in
Prescott Valley at Robert and Valley Road. Every Tuesday, while the weather's still good and it's running out, but every Tuesday I'm at Quail Woods Golf Course. Tuesday afternoon from 4 to 6. It's busy out there.
Yeah.
We've got a good crowd. And I play around town all the time. You'll see me.
So pop into pop into a bar, pop into a juke joint, pop into a restaurant.
Pop on Facebook.
And we'll
you can get a lot of my originals on Reverb Nation/Paul T. Morris.
Great.
They're free. Some of the songs I'll probably play for you on this show are on there.
Well, we made it just about an hour.
Wow, wonderful.
And not once did chemtrails come up.
I know, and that's
did
something.
Did I just spin you into
No, and that's something.
All right, let's take a minute here. We'll stop. We'll get you another drink. You can get your guitar, and we're going to hear a couple of songs. I'm going to split them. I want one to an intro, and then we'll close out with one or two.
That'd be great.
Okay. All right, thanks, Paul.
Thanks so much, Matt. Pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Well, that woman of mine, she came at a time when I was less than half a man. I was down on my luck and living out of my truck. I just didn't give a damn. Well, it was August, I think, when we first shared a drink. We talked about better days. And over a meal, I started to feel the rest of my life was in place. Well, she makes each day a special occasion, just the way the sun comes up in her eyes. And her love is my only salvation, and that is why I'm just crazy about that woman of mine. Well, that woman of mine, yeah, she's one of a kind. She's deeper than a walk in the woods. And the love that I tried so long to deny, she made it so gentle and good. Now to try and express all my thankfulness, take till the end of time. So just let me say I devote every day loving that woman of mine. Well, she makes makes each day a special occasion. Just the way the sun comes up in her eyes. And her love is my only salvation. That is why I'm just crazy about that woman of mine. I'm crazy about her all the time. I'm just crazy. There you go, my friends. Harley was David's son. Born living on the run. Lived by the dream and he died by the gun. He said, ride, Harley, ride. Harley was 33 when a friend introduced him to me. In his eyes you could see the fire burning free. Looked like a warrior dressed in black. Gun on his side, an eagle on his back. And a look on his face that said, don't tread on me. Harley was David's son. Born living on the run. Lived by the dream and he died by the gun. They said, ride, Harley, ride. Well, Harley rode coast to coast. Had a scooter called the Holy Ghost. He found the things he loved the most were just outside the law. He's in and out of those county jails. Just did the time and no money for bail. But you know Harley never failed to walk tall. Harley was David's son. He was born living on the run. Lived by the dream and he died by the gun. They said, ride, Harley, ride. Oh, Harley met his fate. Little old bar out there off the interstate. And he drew his gun a bit too late this time. The room exploded, Harley fell. Shotgun blew him all to hell. The other guy died as well. That's how it goes sometimes. But Harley was David's son. He's born living on the run. Lived by the dream and he died by the gun. They said, ride, Harley, ride, Harley, ride.